From national news in D.C. to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol, this is your Capitol Connection. And now, bringing the Capitol to you, here's your host, Nate Groz.
And welcome to Capitol Connection, where we are bringing the Capitol to you every week from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln. And today, we are talking about the President's Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. What should we make of this selection? What do we know about his judicial philosophy, and how will it impact the balance of the Supreme Court, especially on pro-life and pro-family issues? Plus, we're going to talk about recent developments in Congress to protect faith-based foster care and adoption agencies and what it means for religious freedom across the country. But first today, I wanted to highlight an important new pro-life opportunity where your voice can help make a difference in saving lives. Last month, the Trump administration announced the Protect Life Rule to stop Title X taxpayer subsidies of organizations that perform or refer for abortions. And right now, the United States Department of Health and Human Services is conducting a public comment period before the rule can go into effect. And this past year, Nebraska Family Alliance worked tirelessly to support the governor's budget to ensure that no Title X taxpayer money go to abortion providers in Nebraska. And now you and I have the chance to do the same at the federal level and make sure that no Title X taxpayer money in any state is being used to subsidize the abortion industry. And you can visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org, click on our action alert, and submit a public comment to DHHS by July 31st. And I can tell you, the abortion lobby is desperately trying to stop this rule. They are flooding DHHS with negative comments. That's why your voice is so important. So please take a moment. It just takes a minute. Visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org right on the homepage. Click on the action alert. It'll direct you to where you need to go to leave a public comment in support of the Protect Life Rule. Tell DHHS that abortion is not healthcare and taxpayers should no longer be forced to subsidize the abortion industry. All the information is at NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org, and your voice will help make a huge difference in protecting life. I'm pleased now to welcome back to the show today Jonathan Alexander, Director of Public Policy for Liberty Counsel, an international nonprofit litigation, education, and policy organization. Jonathan is a good friend, and he's out on the front lines in D.C. fighting to protect religious freedom, sanctity of life, and the family. Jonathan, it's great to have you on the show again today. How are things out in our nation's capital?
Well, Nate, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on. As you can imagine, things are very busy in the nation's capital. This has been a season of harvest, really. We're seeing a lot of victories for the pro-life, pro-family movement in this upcoming judicial nominee and hopeful confirmation kind of settles in the fact that we are really in a season where we're seeing a lot of good for the pro-life, pro-family movement.
It's certainly an exciting time, and that's a great way to describe it. And as you mentioned, probably at the top of that list is the president's second nominee to the Supreme Court, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And this is shaping up to be an extended conversation that our country is going to have about the type of judge that we should be looking for to serve on the Supreme Court. So, Jonathan, what do you make of the president's selection of Judge Kavanaugh to replace Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court?
Well, the president, he's hit another home run, right? I think Neil Gorsuch was definitely one of the best jurists that we've had in this country, and we saw Trump's pick of him just a few months ago. And now with Brett Kavanaugh, he's in the same line as Neil Gorsuch. And I think it was telling when President Trump did the introduction or the announcement that he had Ed Meese there, the former attorney general for Reagan. He also had Scalia's wife there, and he presented both of those individuals and sort of immediately drew the line to Brett Kavanaugh, just saying that there is a legacy and a tradition of excellence from the bench that Brett Kavanaugh can fit if he actually continues the work that he's doing in the mold of some of these prior jurists that were mentioned. President Trump noted that Kavanaugh is a judge's judge. Kavanaugh's opinions have been cited by the court. He has over 300 opinions. The Supreme Court has mentioned him and has referred to his opinions over a dozen times. Over 210 judges around the country have sided with Kavanaugh's opinions. So it's without a doubt that he's completely competent. He excels in his writing and his reasoning, but also has the personality, the family tradition, and the faith, really, that gives him a comprehensive, makes him a comprehensive candidate, makes him certainly a very good pick from President Trump.
Well, that's really an important insight for our listeners to know, and certainly some encouraging signs there. Jonathan, what do we know about Judge Kavanaugh and his judicial philosophy and how that might impact or shift the balance on the Supreme Court?
Well, his philosophy is simple and straightforward. He says a judge must be independent, must interpret the law, not make it. You know, he understands that the Constitution, as in the words of President Trump, is the crown jewel of our nation, that it is the central document that, you know, that dictates how all of our rights are to be allocated and interpreted and really protected from government, from intrusion. Judge Kavanaugh says that document ought to be interpreted, and any law that stands against it, of course, is unconstitutional law, but any law that is written must be interpreted within the four corners of that document. And that's a very straightforward approach that certainly is not reflective of the left, that sees the Constitution as a sort of a living, breathing document that can be malleable or changeable depending on the seasons. Judge Kavanaugh has over 12 million documents or in individual pages that you can read through. And throughout his consistent record, his 12 years on the bench, you'll see that he's upheld this view that a judge must be independent and only interpret the law, interpret what the Constitution says. I mentioned that 12 million document just to sort of hint at the timeline for what would be happening in the next few months as the Senate really confirms. Just because of, you know, such expansive past and all the work that he's done, there are over 12 million documents that they'll have to pull, whether it's emails when he was working for the president or, you know, different articles that he's written, just to comb through. But even up until this point, all the work that's been done in the background to try to see what kind of a man Brett Kavanaugh is, he's held on to this true judicial philosophy that a judge must be independent and must be constrained by his role as simply interpreting the law.
And so what kind of timeline can we or should we expect as this process plays out? Are you hearing when we might have a confirmation hearing or potentially have a vote in the United States Senate on Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation?
Well, he's already making the rounds on Capitol Hill on the Senate side. I think earlier this week he was given a tour by Mike Pence, really introduced on Capitol Hill. I think Wednesday of this past week, he actually met with Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska, and so he's making his tours around Senate offices. It's up to Chuck Grassley and the Judiciary Committee to see if they can begin hearings at the end of this summer, so July and August, making full use of the August time. I think the Senate's not taking a recess, so he'll be able to hopefully schedule those hearings during that time. The ultimate goal is to have him, the vote, the confirmation hearings, all that taken care of and him being sworn in before the start of the October Supreme Court term, so that there aren't only eight persons on the bench and you're not getting 4-4 splits, but that Judge Kavanaugh can come in and be prepared to continue the work that he's been doing for the past 12 years on the bench of the U.S. Court of Appeals, extend that work over here to the Supreme Court, and continue ruling in the ways that he has, consistent with the Constitution. So we're looking, hopefully, for his confirmation to occur before the start of the October term.
You know, Jonathan, it was so striking to me, and I'm sure you saw that the night that the president made his announcement that he was selecting Judge Kavanaugh, there were protesters outside of the Supreme Court, but they had a bunch of pre-made signs that, you know, said oppose Judge Kavanaugh, but then there were signs prepared that said oppose Judge Barrett or Judge Kethledge. What type of arguments are you hearing already in opposition to Judge Kavanaugh, and just how fierce is the opposition from the left going to get in their attempts to block his nomination?
You're absolutely right. You saw a lot of pre-planned speeches. I think Senator Elizabeth Warren had a canned speech that you can definitely see. She was just inserting the name of Kavanaugh. The signs, as you mentioned, the T-shirts that were already made. You know, the left would oppose anyone that Trump brought to the fore. So Judge Kavanaugh is shouldn't be surprised by it, and they certainly don't think that the individuals supporting his confirmation are at all shocked by the vitriol attacks against the left, from the left. Certainly, they have been raising two issues to the front. The first is the pro-life issue. I think they understand very clearly that a fifth and ultimately a sixth vote could overturn Roe v. Wade. Could really make a dent in the abortion industry, this culture of death. And they see Judge Kavanaugh's appointment as a real threat to that, which, for pro-lifers and folks in the pro-family movement, that is probably some of the best news, and that's one of the best reasons why individuals support his candidacy, because they do see this ultimate end to Roe v. Wade in the culture of death. So many in the left have said, women's rights will be eviscerated, will be going backwards to back alleys, and individuals dying from improperly done abortions. There's that's probably one of the biggest attacks against him. In his judicial philosophy and in his judicial history, he's looked to Justice Rehnquist as sort of his standard or his hero, a person that he emulates when it comes to his judicial philosophy, and takes from that that the abortion issue is not an enumerated right. There's no history or traditional argument in favor of abortion, and as such, you can see that if it were to come across his desk, he'd certainly be an individual that would vote in favor of life and to oppose this abortion law that has really devastated our country for the past 40 years. So the left's biggest assault against him, or his biggest attack against him, for pro-lifers and pro-families, is probably his strongest badge of honor. The left would oppose anyone that Trump put forward, but they will have a tough time finding ways to oppose such a exceptional jurist as Brett Kavanaugh is.
So the big question, Jonathan, is then, are you confident that the United States Senate and Mitch McConnell will be able to get his nomination approved and ultimately that we will see a Judge Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court?
I think it's confident that the votes are there. I'm definitely confident that there are enough Republicans in office to move his votes along. I don't think the Democrats will be able to obstruct. There are certainly certain Democrats from red states. So these are blue senators in red states that, if this vote is done before the election, would have a very strong incentive to vote in favor of this nominee. So I think certainly the votes are there. But of course, there are Republicans in name only. There are a few that have had a bone to pick with the Trump administration for the past year and a half, and they may use this nomination process as a way to throw their weight around, or really use this as a final shot or final jab against the administration. Ultimately, you hope that where their legacy fits in history would curb any attitudes against them. Hopefully they would want their legacy to be a vote in favor of, an exceptional jurist that was in the mold of Scalia and a Gorsuch, an exceptional jurist that certainly ultimately led to the end of some of these morally bankrupt decisions out of the court. You'd hope that some of these weak Republicans would understand the big picture and really leave their personal, their individual political aspirations aside and cast their vote in a very proper way, but it'd be soon to tell. It's too soon to really see what issues they'll raise during this interview process or even the nomination process to know how they'll ultimately fall. But we are confident that the votes are there. It's not a complete win. It's not something that you can pay zero attention to, but the votes are there, and I think the work can ultimately get us to a complete confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, as I mentioned, hopefully before the October term.
Jonathan, I really appreciate your insight into this. It's such a big issue that we're going to keep hearing a lot about. And the last time that we had you on the show, we talked about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case involving right. Christian cake baker Jack Phillips. And at that time, we were still awaiting the United States Supreme Court to hear oral arguments and make their ruling. And now we do have that ruling, and they ruled strongly in favor of Jack Phillips. And since then, there's been some arguments that some on the left have tried to make that this is somehow comparable to racial discrimination during the Jim Crow era. And you were a part of a strong coalition supporting Jack, including a group of African-American leaders, pastors, and policy experts. So what's your reaction first to the Supreme Court ruling in Jack's favor in this argument that we're hearing that we've now entered a new era comparable to racial discrimination in the Deep South?
Yeah, well, first off, and you know Jack personally, Nate, and I as well, I think it's the most important thing is that Jack's going to be able to do what he's always done with his business and with his entire career, his entire passion, which is create custom artwork that promotes messages he believes. He's in the wedding industry and is going to be able to continue celebrating natural marriages. And that's something, if you know Jack personally, that gives you complete joy, just to see him being able to be back at his craft. You also mentioned the implications or even the racial implications of a ruling like this, or what the left is attempting to spin as a racial implication. It is completely unfounded that someone would make a comparison between natural marriage and the promotion of one man, one woman marriages, and saying that's akin to racism. It's a false narrative that doesn't hold any water. It pits against each other, this newfounded sexual rights with the immutable characteristic of race. And anytime that argument is brought up, it fails. It continues to fail. Jack would serve all people. There was not a blanket rejection of anyone because of who they are or who they were or what they participated in. It was saying that, my religious liberty and my religious beliefs limits me from endorsing certain activities. And the government having such an overwhelming animus towards Jack, when the actual record reached the Supreme Court, the decision can have been so clear, 7-2 majority dictating that religious animus can't be tolerated in this country, and that false comparisons to race or to different things in our history still don't measure up to this final and absolute right of an individual's ability to believe in their heart a certain way and also operate their business according to those beliefs. And we're glad that Jack was vindicated in that sense. His cake shop is back open for business. His wedding industry, that part of his portfolio is active again. And we're really happy for that victory. And we'll continue to make alarm and stand against these, soji laws that are really pitting at the crosshairs religious freedom and these newfound sexual identities. Great win for Jack.
I agree completely, Jonathan. And continuing on the subject of religious freedom, we got more good news this past week when an amendment to protect the religious freedom of faith-based adoption providers was passed by the House Appropriations Committee. And the amendment, which started as the Child Welfare Provider Inclusion Act, passed on a 29-23 vote. And essentially, it would keep child welfare service providers from being discriminated against due to their moral and religious convictions. So, Jonathan, what is the significance behind this, and why is this an important victory?
Well, it's a very important victory. You'll remember in the past 10 or so years, same-sex marriage really started penetrating the states. States like Massachusetts and Illinois effectively kicked out religious groups, kicked out Bible-believing parents from the adoption industry. They were no longer qualified. Catholic Charities in particular were no longer qualified to do adoptions in the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, if they weren't willing to place, contrary to their religious beliefs, they weren't willing to place children and orphans in homes of same-sex marriage couples. Of course, that would be in violation of their religious beliefs, and so Catholic Charities, who had been operating for 120 years in certain states, was effectively kicked out. Well, this amendment says that, you know, when funds are being appropriated to foster centers and other organizations that are placing children, that they cannot exclude organizations based on their religious faith, that all providers that qualify, that are have been doing the work in these states for so long, placing children in homes with families that love them, can continue doing their work. Of course, it, as you mentioned, it passed on the House side in the Appropriations Committee. Ultimately, it has to pass the entire Congress, so it will, you know, probably face a tough battle during conferencing when it comes to the Senate, when the two bills have to be consolidated. And so we, I'm glad you mentioned it, because we do need to keep our finger on the pulse and make sure that the senators know how important this bill is to the entire religious liberty movement, but also how important it is just for the children that will be affected, the children that could ultimately be placed in homes with loving parents that otherwise wouldn't, if this sort of discrimination against religious groups continues.
That's such an important point, Jonathan. So again, on the on those lines, why is this important, not just for people of faith or faith-based adoption agencies, but really all of the innocent children that they are trying to serve who are waiting to be placed in a loving home?
Right, exactly, yeah. It can be stated any better. These children, they're looking for a loving home. And otherwise qualified parents are now excluded from the system simply because there's, once again, a religious animus. There's another perspective of this. So they are birth mothers. The actual birth mothers of these children want to make what will ultimately be their final decision for their child, want to see that their children are placed in good homes. And so even for the birth mothers, knowing that their children are still in the system, and simply because government bureaucracy wants to exclude an entire crop of qualified parents, gives that birth mother who's already suffering the fact that she has to give up her child even more chagrin, knowing that her child is stuck in the system simply because government bureaucracy wants to really tighten the noose on religious liberty. So from the perspective of religious organizations, you know, there's strong arguments for amendments like this. From the perspective of the children themselves, there's strong arguments, but also from the birth mother, we see, you know, several reasons why government should not be excluding religious groups and Bible-believing parents from the adoption system.
Jonathan Alexander, Director of Public Policy with Liberty Counsel, it's been such a pleasure to talk about these recent developments from the Supreme Court to religious freedom. We so appreciate you taking the time to speak with us here in Nebraska. And so, Jonathan, my last question for you, we've been talking about some really divisive and at times controversial issues that you are really working in the front lines on. So how do you personally handle really the lack of civility or civil discourse that we're seeing across the country and the rise in aggression from the left as you're working on these issues when things can get really heated and controversial?
Right. Good question, Nate. And there have been personal attacks, and certainly attacks against the organization that I represent, Liberty Counsel, Southern Poverty Law Center, continues to try to degrade the work and our mission, like labeling us as a hate group. But I mean, those attacks, honestly, they pale in comparison to the eternal perspective that we have. I mean, we know that we are advancing God's kingdom on this earth. And that's the ultimate satisfaction. You know that but for you actually making progress and changing culture, changing society to promote good moral issues, that individuals would not pay any attention to you. And so when that when you put those things in perspective, when you understand that you're working for the kingdom, that, you know, you're certainly within God's favor and under his protection, of course you do have to answer to these attacks, and they do hurt when they come. But ultimately, you put them in perspective and understand that the gain and the reward that you have eternally severely overshadows whatever temporal persecution that you may feel. And with that, you know, we're encouraged to continue persevering and continue moving forward on these and many other issues.
Well, that's such an important message, Jonathan, and I appreciate you sharing it. I know our listeners in Nebraska appreciate it, and we're so grateful for the work that you and Liberty Counsel are doing in our nation's capital to protect the sanctity of life, religious freedom, and the family. So once again, Jonathan Alexander, Director of Public Policy with Liberty Counsel. Jonathan, thanks so much for being on the show with us today, and thanks for your great work.
Thank you so much, Nate. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
And that's all the time we have for this week. For more information, you can visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. I'm your host, Nate Groz, Policy Director for Nebraska Family Alliance. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.